Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
For those of you who may not be familiar, tonight's author, well, I've had an epiphany while clerking for a Supreme Court justice and decided she wanted to go back and read and write and study and think about what makes us happy. So that produced the number one best-selling Happiness Project, then followed by Happier at Home. Both of those have been amazing things. Tonight's book is Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives. Please join me in welcoming Gretchen Rubin.
So first, thank you so much for being here. I'm a huge fan of Tattered Cover. I've never been to this store before, so this is a big treat. I love a gorgeous bookstore. I love Tattered Cover, so it's a thrill to be here. I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet if you want to sign up for my newsletter or my daily happiness quotation. And as some of you I know already know, I started a podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin with my sister, the excellent Elizabeth Kraft. And so some people have said to me, I would like to listen to a podcast, but I don't know how. So there's instructions here for iPhone and Android if you want to do it. But I need my little sheets back. I don't have enough to leave behind. So just I'm going to pass these around. So I'm going to talk for a minute about how I got the idea to tackle the subject of habits. And then I'm going to talk about three threshold questions that have probably occurred to you if you've thought about your own habits or possibly changing the habits of someone else, which is often a temptation. And then I'm going to talk about five things that surprised me as I was writing Better Than Before. And then we're going to have questions and answers, and that's always my favorite part. So be thinking about what your questions are. I love to hear what other people are thinking about habits. So I got the idea to study habits because I'd been reading and researching and talking to people about happiness for years, and I began to notice a pattern, which was that often when I talked to people about a big happiness boost that they had achieved or a big happiness challenge that they were facing, they were pointing to something that at its core was a habit. And maybe they didn't think of it that way. They'd say something like, well, I'm just exhausted all the time. But really that was related to a habit of not getting enough sleep. And so I began to think more and more and start reading and researching about habits and how habits form. Then I had lunch with a friend, and my interest in habits turned into a full-blown obsession. And she said very casually, she's like, well, you know, I would be happier if I exercised. And this is the weird thing. When I was in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice, but I can't go running now. Why? I thought, well, why? Why? At one time it was effortless, and now she can't form that habit. What is going on? And I became determined to solve the puzzle of habits. And as I got deeper and deeper into the research, I started to get puzzled because there were these questions that seemed obvious to me that no one else seemed to recognize or address. For instance, there's always an assumption that we all have the same attitude towards habits, and that we all have the same aptitude for forming habits. And that seemed to me to be obviously not the case. Why is it that habits sometimes form overnight, and that sometimes we can't change a habit no matter how hard we try? It's kind of understandable why it's hard to form a habit of something you don't like to do, but why is it often just as hard to form a habit of something that you love to do? Like, it's easy to see why you might not be able to read every day if you don't like to read, but what if you love to read? Why can't you get yourself to read? Why is it that most successful dieters gain all the weight back plus more? Why is it that we are so unmoved by the consequences of our habits? Up to one half of American adults do not take their prescription medication for a chronic health problem. Why? So I was determined to figure this out. But there's some initial questions to think about. And one question is, like, should we even be bothering thinking about this anyway? Like, why waste your time thinking about habits? Well, it turns out research shows that about 40% of daily life is governed by habits. So habits are the invisible architecture of everyday life. If we have habits that work for us, we're much more likely to be happier, healthier, and more productive. If we have habits that don't work for us, it is going to be much more difficult. Habits shape our existence and our future. Well, then you might say, okay, well, what is a habit? And I use the term habit very colloquially. Like, I'm in the habit of going to the gym. And often when people are talking about a habit, they focus on the aspect of frequency or repetition or the familiarity of cues around a behavior. But I've really come to believe that the key about a habit is decision making, or I should say the lack of decision making. Habits are helpful because they get us out of the draining, difficult business of making decisions. I don't decide to get up at 6 a.m. I don't decide to skip dessert. I decided that long ago. This is a behavior that's on autopilot. It takes no decision for me, so it takes no energy from me. Sometimes people say to me, I want to learn to make healthy choices throughout my day. And I'm like, don't do that. Because every time, you know, you choose, you got the opportunity to make the wrong choice. And you probably will, at least half the time. You want to choose once and then stop choosing. Put that behavior on autopilot. Habits are helpful in that they free us from having to make decisions and from having to use self-control. So then we come to the big question. How then do we change our habits? And that is what I try to explain in Better Than Before. How do we change our habits? Now, there is no shortage of expert advice. You know, we've all heard it. Do it first thing in the morning. Start small. Do it for 30 days. Give yourself a cheat day. But the fact is, those strategies work sometimes for some people, but they don't work for everybody. They don't work all the time. What is everything that we can do? And what I discovered is that there are 21 different strategies that people use to master their habits. And you use the same strategy to make habits and to break habits. It doesn't matter if you're making or breaking. Now, sometimes I tell people there are 21 and they get this sort of startled, terrified look in their eyes, like, oh my gosh, I can't handle it. How can I possibly think about 21 strategies? But this is good, because what it means is that you can, there's a lot from which to choose, because it turns out the key thing when you're trying to figure out how to change your habits is that you have to know yourself. What is true about you? You're not the same as everybody else. What is true about you? What is the habit that you are trying to form? What are the circumstances that you are in? And there's a bunch of things for you to choose from so that you can pick and choose the things that are going to be right for you. Now, I love all 21 strategies. They're all effective. They're all powerful. Some are funnier than others. The strategy of loophole spotting is the funniest strategy. If you want to read one chapter first, read that one. That's the hilarious strategy. But I'm tonight going to talk about five strategies that surprised me. Because when I was doing this research, there was a lot that I found that was familiar, but there were many things that surprised me, or that were even counterintuitive, things that I thought I would see the opposite from what I ended up believing. Because a lot of habit stuff, it's powerful, but you kind of know it. Like monitoring. We all know about monitoring, that if you monitor something, you're probably going to do a better job. If you want to eat more healthfully, you keep a food journal. If you want to walk more, you use a step counter. If you want to keep a budget better, you write down every dollar that you spend. Monitoring. It's super effective, but it's familiar. So tonight we're going to focus on the surprising things, and then we'll go to questions. So the first thing that really surprised me and was so helpful for me to understand about myself is the strategy of abstaining. But the key thing to remember about the strategy of abstaining is that it is not for everyone. This is a strategy that is highly effective for some people. And for others, it does not work at all. You have to know how you fit into this categories. And here's the difference. Some people are abstainers and some people are moderators. I'm an abstainer. And I figured out I was an abstainer when I was reading something by one of my favorite authors, Samuel Johnson, the 18th century English essayist. And he was at a party, and someone said, well, would you take a little wine? And he said, I can't have a little. Abstinence is as easy to me as temperance would be difficult. And when I read that, I thought, that's me. I can have no thin mints. I can have 10 thin mints. But I cannot have 2 thin mints. And the thing about abstainers is that for us, it is easier to have none. Abstaining is easier. We're all or nothing people. If we get started, we find it very hard to stop. But if we never start, it's easy. On the other hand, moderators get kind of panicky and rebellious if they're told they can never do or have something. They want to have it sometimes or a little bit. Often if they're told they can have something, they don't even want it. And here's the sign of a true moderator. Somewhere squirreled away, they've got a bar of fine chocolate. And every day they eat one square of that bar. As an abstainer, I would be haunted for the whole day about the chocolate bar. The whole day would be about now, later, today, tomorrow, my birthday, half of one, does this count? But moderators, that's what works for them. So based on what I've said, how many people here would say they're probably abstainers? And how many people would probably say they're moderators? And thus we see the potential for massive household conflict. So the ice cream. Don't buy the ice cream. If you buy the ice cream, I'm going to eat the whole thing. You got to learn to be moderate. Like, just have a little bit. You got to be better control of yourself. Why did you eat the whole thing? You didn't save any for me. On and on and on. But the fact is, there's no right way or wrong way. It's whatever way works for you. And as an abstainer, moderators always say things to me like, you're so rigid. You need to learn to, be easier on yourself. And as an abstainer, I want to say to moderators, you keep breaking your own rules. Why don't you just go cold turkey? There's no right way or wrong way. It's whatever works for you. And this isn't just something about food. It's anything that you feel a strong temptation. We can all be moderators with weak temptation. How do you handle a strong temptation? For instance, technology. My sister had to give up Candy Crush. She couldn't play it a little bit. You know? I know a guy, he gave up ESPN.com. You know, he's like, I go for 10 minutes and 3 hours later, I have no idea where I've been. So if you've tried to be moderate, try abstaining and vice versa. And here's the thing about abstaining, in case you haven't tried it. It's easier. Sometimes people say to me, well, it's easy for you to be an abstainer, because I have to admit, you would not believe what I abstain from. It is pretty extreme. It's easier for you because you have so much self-control. No, I don't have enough self-control to be moderate. For an abstainer, abstaining is easier. That is surprising, but that's what I found, and I've heard from a lot of people something similar. And sort of in a related mode, and is the strategy of treats. Now, I have to say, if the strategy of loophole spotting is the funniest strategy, the strategy of treats is definitely the most fun strategy. And this is the strategy, because what I found is that we really need to load ourselves with healthy treats. Now, sometimes people think, well, it sounds selfish and self-indulgent to give yourself a lot of healthy treats. But in fact, when we give ourselves treats, we make ourselves feel energized and comforted and cared for. And when we give ourselves treats, our self-command rises. And that's what we need to stick to our good habits. We want to have self-command. They were doing studies, and when they would give people like a surprise gift or have them watch a funny little video, their self-command rose. When we give more to ourselves, we can ask more from ourselves. And so it's important to get healthy treats. But they need to be healthy, because you don't want to do something to make yourself feel better where you end up making yourself feel worse. And what are the big three of the unhealthy treats? You know them if you think about them. First, food and drink. Second, shopping. Third, screen time. Perhaps taking the form of binge watching the entire season of House of Cards. Now, all of these can be healthy treats for some people, but they very often become unhealthy treats. But one issue for a lot of adults is they don't really have a lot of ideas for healthy treats. So we all need to be on the lookout for good, healthy treats for ourselves. So, for instance, a friend of mine, her treat is that she has to get everybody in her family, going in the morning, and then they all leave, and then she goes back to bed. Sometimes she's dressed for work. Sometimes she's just in her pajamas. She just goes back to bed under the covers and lies there for 20 minutes. She's like, it's the best part of my day. That's a good treat. Another guy, I was talking to a guy, and he's like, well, I don't give myself any treats. And I was like, I bet you do. And he did. And he had a good treat, which was every Tuesday morning when iTunes releases new music, he buys himself some new music. That's good. My husband does crossword puzzles on his iPad. A lot of people have told me that podcasts are a treat, which is great, since I have my new podcast. Yes, that's a great treat. It's that we have to be thinking about how we're like cell phones that need to be plugged in to get a battery charge. Because when we don't charge our batteries, we get into that mode of, I need it. I want it. I have to have it. And that's often when we reach for those unhealthy treats. So have the healthy treats. Visiting a bookstore. What could be a bigger treat than that, right? So that's the strategy of treats. Surprising because it is so fun. Then there are two surprising strategies, one having to do with beginnings and one having to do with endings. So one of the things that is very true about the strategy of the clean slate is that it is not a strategy that is available to us at all times, because it is a strategy that is only useful at a time of transition. And we're not often in times of transition. But the thing is, when you are in a time of transition, this is a golden opportunity for you to tinker with your habits. So take advantage of it. Because when we go through a big transition, all our old habits are wiped away. The slate is clean, and new habits can crowd in much more easily. So it's a great time to put your new habits into place. But the first marks on the slate often persist. Temporary often becomes permanent. So you want to do from the beginning what you want to be doing as you continue. So what are some transitions? A transition might be a transition in a relationship, marriage, divorce, a new baby, a new puppy, a new boss. Transition in circumstances, a new job, a new school. Or most often, it's a change in residence. When they looked at successful habit change, they found that 36% were associated with a move. So if you are moving, it's an amazing opportunity to reshape your habits. And in fact, I feel like a lot of people quit smoking when they move, because everything is wiped away. You don't have those old habits, so you can recreate new habits. Now, I used this strategy of the clean slate to great effect completely accidentally, well before I knew what it was, years ago. I started out as a lawyer, and my husband and I were moving to New York City, and I was starting a clerkship. And I had figured out, for a variety of reasons, that if I wanted to exercise, the only time I could really do it was if I exercised before work. And by chance, the week that I started, my judge was at a judicial conference. So he was out of town. And I thought, well, I wasn't used to New York, so I was like, I don't know how long the subway's going to take, and I need to work out and take a shower and blow dry my hair and then walk to the courthouse. I don't know how long this is all going to take. So I thought, I really should go every day that first week so I really know how much time to allow, because I don't want to be late once my judge is back in his chambers. Well, that was actually brilliant. Because that was just my day. That was when I woke up. That's when I left for work. This is how the whole thing. I just got used to it. That became the habit without me thinking. But I could just as easily imagine myself having thought, well, it's really hard starting a new job. I'm going to be really tired. I'm going to cut myself a little slack at the beginning. And then after I've gotten eased into it, a couple weeks in, then I'll start going to the gym. But then it would have felt like a big imposition. Ugh, I'm getting out early. Oh, I got to schlep all the way down there. It would have been a lot harder to form the habit of exercising. It would have seemed much more difficult. So that's, if you have a transition, take advantage of it, because it's a golden opportunity. And then there's this, the the danger posed by finish lines. And I have to admit, this is something that puzzled me for a very long time. I could not figure this out. It did not make sense to me. And I realized that there was an issue with, there was something. I couldn't figure out what it was because it was uncanny. Several people told me exactly the same anecdote in almost exactly the same words, and it didn't make sense to me. It contradicted what I would have expected people to say happened, and I had to figure out why. And so most memorably, it was when I was back at my college reunion, and an old friend said to me, well, I wanted to change my habits, because I do have to admit, I talk to everybody about their habits all the time. So there I was at my reunion asking this guy who I hadn't seen in 20 years about his exercise habits. And he's like, well, I wanted to form the habit of exercise, so I decided to train for the marathon. And I love training for the marathon. And I bored my family and friends talking about how great it was to train for the marathon. And I ran the marathon, and it was amazing. And then I took those rest days that they tell you to take, and I haven't run since. Well, this is just one guy. I wouldn't really have thought anything of it. But several people told me the story. And it didn't make sense to me. Because I thought, wouldn't it have just the opposite effect? You'd think a big meeting a goal like that would energize you. And you'd feel so gratified. It would just make you all the more attached to your habits. It would lock you in. How is it that... And they were like just immediately stopping. It wasn't even like they were, it was like gradually dropping off. All of them had the same thing. Absolute effortless training, never ran again. So weird. But I realized that the question held the answer. It was the finish line. He was finished. He thought he was forming a habit, but he was actually working towards a goal. And he met that goal, and he hit the finish line. And then he was done. The fact is, to start running, he would have had to start over. Starting over is hard. It's often harder than starting. And when we reach a goal, we feel like we've accomplished what we set out to accomplish. We're finished. We're done. And so what I've concluded is that when there's something that you want to do with an eye to forming a habit, you want to see it maybe as a milestone. It's an exciting milestone. It's a gratifying milestone. But it's just one milestone, and there will be many milestones that you will pass. It's not a finish line. Because when people hit that finish line, you know, if you're doing the 60-day detox, what happens on day 62? If you're training for the marathon, what's happening a week after the marathon? You have to plan for what's going to happen. What does life look like on the other side of that divide? And I suspect that there's many reasons why I think that dieters struggle to maintain weight loss, but I think that this is part of it. Because often when people set out to lose weight, they have a goal weight. That's what it's called. It's a goal weight. I weigh 160 pounds, I'm going to lose 20 pounds, and when I hit my goal weight of 140, I'm finished. Then I will go back to eating normally. And when I eat normally, I weigh 160 pounds. Hitting that finish line, you know, you feel like, okay, my work here is done. But with a habit, the idea is that you're going to do it indefinitely. And that's kind of scary, so I'm not saying that you should dwell on that, because it can be a little bit terrifying to think about doing this forever. So you just think about, well, this is what I'm doing now. What am I doing after the marathon? What am I doing after the detox? What am I doing? You know, this is a milestone. It's something along the way. And not get hung up on the finish line. And then the last surprising strategy I'll talk about, and then we'll have the questions, is, I have to say, this has surprised me for years. It surprised me when I was doing my happiness research. It surprises me in my habits research. I just think it's surprising. And that is the, to me, seemingly quite disproportionate effect on most people, not on everybody, but most people, of clutter. It's surprising to me the degree to which, for most people, outer order contributes to inner calm and inner self-command. Because the fact is, a crowded coat closet is not a big deal. And yet over and over, people tell me, and I certainly have felt this way myself, that there's something about getting control over the stuff of life that makes you feel more in control of your life generally. And if it's an illusion, it's a helpful illusion. And there is just something about getting rid of things that don't work, that you don't use, that you don't love, and clearing things out and having more space and having clear counters and shelves that makes people feel more in command of themselves. And that's what you want with your habits. You want to feel in command of yourself. And I have to say, you know, I talk to people about their habits and their resolutions and their happiness constantly. And I always say, well, what worked for you? What did you try? And I've heard, you know, 1,000 things. But the one thing that people most often mention as a habit that they've acquired that makes them happier, and I am not saying this is the most significant thing you could do for your happiness. It's not the most important habit you could form, but people do mention it most often. And that is the habit of making your bed. How many people here regularly make their bed? How many people here regularly make their bed in a hotel room on the morning they check out? Oh, yeah. You went up right away. All right, we'll talk. That's right. That's right. There's no substitute for a made bed. And, you know, and why is this? I don't know. Like a Navy SEAL gave a speech where he talked about the importance of making his bed. There's something about this small, manageable action that you do first thing that just makes people feel good. You know, either start their day right, they're keeping their word to themselves, it just looks better. There's something about making your bed and clearing clutter. It just it shouldn't matter as much as it does. There's one habit that for many people has proved to be extremely helpful in fighting clutter, because clutter is just this relentless force in our lives. And that is the habit of the one-minute rule. Anything you can do in less than a minute, do without delay. Hang up your coat. Rip open a letter, scan it and toss it. Print something out and file it. Put the jar back on the peanut butter jar. Put the lid back on the jar of peanut butter. And this keeps those little tasks from piling up, because a lot of times it's not that there's so much to do, but it's just all these tiny things that just weigh you down and make you feel like, oh, I don't even know where to get started. And that's not good for habits. You know, it's like tidy areas stay tidy, messy areas get messy. And there's something about being in a place where everything's orderly. You feel more orderly too. It's easier to sort of be disciplined when everything is kind of in its place. And plus, you don't waste all your time and energy looking for your keys. And so there's something about order that seems to have an unusually strong relationship to self-command. So the last thing I would say, and then we'll have questions, is a lot of people are discouraged about their habits. You know, they've tried to change a habit over and over, and they can't seem to do it. And I have to say now, having, you know, spent so much time thinking about it and talking to people about it, is that I think if you really take the time to think about yourself and what's true about you and what you want, what your interests are, what your priorities are, what your values are, what your identity is, and think about how you can put a change in place in a realistic, manageable way, I really do think that there are a lot of options, even for people who feel discouraged and frustrated, that will allow them to make a change in an important habit. And it matters, because when we change our habits, we change our lives. So thank you. Okay, gold star for the first question. Yes. All right, you get the gold star.
I'm Dennis Grogan, and I'm here with a group of 9 people who've been studying happiness for the last 3 months. We call ourselves conscious aging, and we study issues of aging, and happiness is a big part of that. So
excellent.
We studied your first book.
Oh, great.
On the current book, my question is what is this related to neuroplasticity in your mind? Where you're changing your habits, you're changing the way you're thinking?
Yeah, the question is this related to neuroplasticity? When you change your habits, you change your mind. Yes, but I have to say that for me, I am very interested in what can people affect consciously. Like if I had to look at the theme of what I'm interested in terms of behavior change, it's what can people consciously do? I can't do anything in my brain. I can't do anything to my neural circuitry. I can go to bed on time, but I can't. So I don't really spend any time thinking about what's going on in my brain, because that's not something I can see or touch, and it's not something that's my expertise. I'm very focused on, like, what can we consciously change? Now, when we consciously change things, clearly the brain is changing. Obviously the brain is changing. And that's what we're trying to take advantage of, is the brain's drive to put behavior into a habit. The brain is trying to make behaviors into a habit in order to save bandwidth for novel and complex and urgent matters. That's why the brain wants to do it, because that frees up the brain to deal with other things. So it's absolutely affecting the brain in the deepest possible way. It's not something that I look at in the book. Yes. When I was researching the book, I looked a lot about kindergarten design, the design of kindergarten rooms and routines, for exactly that reason.
And I guess I was just curious as to what your experience has been with kids and teaching them habits versus, you know, trying to figure out like their personalities and how right. that plays into habits. And it's a big question, but whatever you can answer about, I guess, just
kids and habits. Well, yeah, because a lot of people want to change the habits of children. One thing I would say is that almost always the first place to start is with yourself. And that if you want to have some kinds of habits, then you should be having those habits yourself, because habits are very catching. That's the strategy of other people. We are constantly passing habits back and forth. There's something called health concordance, which is when two couples, their health habits converge in good ways and bad ways. I had an interesting experience with this recently, because we always go on a beach vacation with my in-laws every year. And by the way, it turns out if you do something three times with your in-laws, it becomes a habit and ingrained in stone. I didn't know that. Now I know, but it's wonderful. It's a wonderful tradition and a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. And we look forward to it every year. But this year I couldn't go because I was coming on my book tour. So the three of them went without me and with my in-laws. So the five of them were on vacation. And my husband emailed me after the third day, and he goes, "Everything's happening an hour and a half later because you're not here." I'm an early riser, and I like to eat dinner early. And so it wasn't like I was going around waking people up, but I was up and around, and so then other people get up and around, and I'd be like, "Hey, is anybody getting hungry?" You know, and just so one person being there affected the habits of five people, you know, without anybody consciously doing anything different. But with children too, you know, it's complicated. Like, all these things depend. You can instill good habits, but then there's also the dreaded backlash. Like, you don't have any sugar in the house, and then that's the kid that eats the entire box of Fruit Loops on the slumber party because they're not used to eating sugar, you know. So it's not so easy. I have to confess, I don't make my children make their bed. Here I just give this long thing about making their bed, but I'm like, if you don't want to, don't. I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm not going to bug you about it. I want you to see, if you know anything about the book and the four tendencies, which I haven't even talked about, but I'm an upholder. And one of the things about being an upholder is I want you to want to make the bed. I don't want to tell you to make the bed. I don't want to make you make the bed. I want you to decide to make the bed, which is even worse. Believe me, I know. So there's just a lot of things. And I think a lot of the strategies that work for adults work for children. Scheduling, monitoring, pairing, convenience. One thing is to make things, if there's a habit you want your children to follow, you should make it as convenient as possible. And one of the habits that I wanted to encourage in my teenager was she was sort of letting her entire weekend be consumed by homework without actually doing much homework. You know what I mean? Maybe you've had the same experience at work where, like, you spend 3 hours putting off doing something, then you sort of do it for 2 hours, and then the whole day's gone. And it's so I said to her, and she really values free time. So I said, "I've noticed that this is what's happening to you, and I know you're not going to like the suggestion, but what would you say if you woke up early on Sunday and worked for like a solid block? And really just tried to get a bunch of it knocked out right first thing in the morning." And to my surprise, she agreed to try it. And she does it. But man, do I make that convenient? Yes, I do. I wake her up with like a gentle kiss. And then she works in my office with me. That's the thing. We're both working. So I'm right there next to her. But I bring her breakfast on a tray. I make her tea and breakfast and bring it up. If it's chilly, I bring her a blanket. You know, I'm like, "Whatever you want, just do your homework." I make it as convenient as possible because it's a hard habit to get up when you're, you know, 15, 16 years old, to get up on a Sunday morning early and work on your homework. She needs greasing the wheels is going to help with that habit, but she's managed to stick to it. So that's good. So convenience and convenience. So a lot of the strategies that work for adults work for children. Yes?
What is the toughest habit you ever formed?
That you mean, you mean that took me the most work to form it? Probably exercise. I'm a real couch potato. And I really didn't want to exercise. But this is a good example of how another person can help a habit. So I was in high school, and I wanted to redecorate my bedroom. And so my father said, you can redecorate your bedroom, but you have to do something for me 20 minutes a day, 4 times a week, and I won't tell you what it is. That seemed intriguing, but I was like, well, I don't know. What could it be? He's a nice man, so it wouldn't be too bad. 20 minutes a day. So I was like, okay. So he said, you just go for a run. And so, and in fact, like I had wanted to start running, and he gave me a little push and sort of said, you know, this is what you need to get going. And I was able from there to start. But I think for me, the habit of exercise, I talk about fixed habits and unfixed habits. So a fixed habit is something like brushing your teeth or wearing a seatbelt. It happens exactly the same way every time. That's much easier. For me, exercise is an unfixed habit. I can't get up and do, when I had my clerkship, I could get up and go to the gym the same way every day. But now I can't. Every day is different. I have to move it around. And some days I do strength training and, you know. It always takes work. It's a habit, but it's always a little bit at risk. I have to do a lot of things to try to make sure that I don't lose track of that habit and sink back into my couch potato ways. So I think it's exercise. Yes?
I've heard that people that have lived a life where they've done the same thing over and over again, like on the same vacation year after year, feel like they've gone on one vacation.
Yes.
And I understand the premise of the decision-making and the lack of it.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile
yes.
those?
Right. So this is a question, if somebody has a very habit-filled life, goes on the same vacation every year, they everything blends together. So how do you reconcile that with the power of habits? You're exactly right. Habits are very powerful and freeing in some ways, but they also have drawbacks. And the drawbacks are they deaden and they speed time. So you're talking about speeding time. The more it's filled with habits, the quicker things go, which is if you start a new job, the first month seems like an era, and then the fifth year goes and you can't remember it, you know? I worked at the Federal Communications Commission for 14 months. It feels like as long as college. So that is very important. Novelty is very important. And if you feel like your life is speeding, introducing some kind of novelty, you know, the biggest thing would be to move to a foreign country where there's so much novelty, because then the brain is slowing down to take in information. I remember somebody said, we were so glad when we had a baby because we felt like our life was speeding by, and then it just slammed to a halt. And every week is so much is happening. Every week is an adventure. So that's, and I've actually been thinking about it for my own life. I feel like it's speeding. I need to introduce novelty. And that was one reason I was excited about the podcast, because I was like, this is something totally new. It'll be novel, so it'll make time richer. Now, habits also deaden. They deaden for the better, and they deaden for the worse. So if something is a habit, you tend to have a less intense emotional reaction to it. So, you know, the first morning cup of coffee that you had was, you know, ecstasy. And now you don't even taste it. Unless you don't get it, then you're frantic. But you don't even taste it. It's the habit. But also, if there's something that makes you very anxious or that's very unpleasant, the more familiar it is, the more the negative feelings will lessen. So it deadens for good and for bad. But you're exactly right to point that out, because habits have negative qualities, definitely. But if you're aware of them, you can kind of counterbalance them, I think. Yes? Yeah. Yes. So the question is, if you have a lot of habits that you want to change, should you work at one at a time or do them all at once? And, you know, I often have the same answer, which is frustrating for everyone, including me, which is, it depends. It depends on you. And some people do better when they start small, when they keep it very manageable, when it's very realistic, when it's one little thing after another, you know, maybe focusing on one habit at a time. But then other people do better when they start big. They lose interest if it's small. They're not interested in small changes. They lose momentum. So they do better if they're doing something big, something dramatic. If you are starting, though, if you're a person who is like, okay, I want to start changing my habits, there are, in the strategy of foundation, is a chapter where I talk about there's four kinds of strategies, four specific strategies that seem to be the most important to get a handle on. These are the habits that if you can get these nailed down, it will be much easier generally to form habits, because these are habits that go directly at self-control. And if you're changing a habit, like, you want to give up self-control, but in order to form the habit, you're going to need to use your self-control. So, and that's eating and drinking. You want to not let yourself get too hungry, for example, because weirdly, one of the reasons that people overeat is because they haven't eaten enough. You skip breakfast, you skip lunch, and then, oh my gosh, dinner, you can't stop eating, you know? And drinking, okay, one of the reasons it's fun is that it lowers your inhibition. So that's not good for habits, eating and drinking. Sleeping. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're totally drained, you're overwhelmed. That's like the 11 p.m. ice cream. You know, you're just like so exhausted. The exercise, just moving around, that tends to give people more self-control, more energy, raises their mood. And then again, uncluttering. That's a place where the uncluttering comes in, because for a lot of people, they just feel more in control of themselves when their stuff is under control. So if you're going to start, I would think about that, those areas. But whether it start big or start small really depends on the person, because people have very different success with very different strategies. Yes. Yes.
And knowing yourself. But is there hope? Have you seen in research people being able to change their tendency? Mm.
Yeah. So your question is, can people change their tendencies? So for those people who don't know their tendencies, I'll just give a quick overview. And the question is, can an obliger become an upholder? That is hilarious, because that's like, so many people have said that to me. So these are the four tendencies, and I'm going to go through them quickly. And I'm going to warn you, it sounds really boring, but it's really, really interesting, so stay with me. You'll see my legal training with my multi-part factorials. But if after you listen to this, you don't know what your tendency is, there is a quiz on my site that will also help you figure out your tendency. And that, I think 117,000 people have taken it at this point, so it's amazing. Okay, so here are the four tendencies. Hang on, prepare to be bored. It's going to get good. So this has to do with how you deal with an expectation. And there are two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, like a work deadline or request from a spouse or a traffic regulation, and inner expectations. Your own desire to keep a New Year's resolution. Your own desire to write a novel in your free time. So how do you respond to outer and inner expectations? Upholders, first category, respond readily to outer expectations and inner expectations alike. They'll meet a work deadline, they'll keep a New Year's resolution without much trouble. They take their commitments to other people very seriously. They really want to meet those expectations, but their expectations for themselves are just as important or more important. Next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do it if it makes sense to them. They hate anything arbitrary or irrational. They want to know reasons. They want to know why they should listen to you. But once they've decided that an expectation makes sense, they can meet it without difficulty. So in a way, they turn everything into an inner expectation. Next, obligers, which is what you're referring to. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So this is my friend on the track team. When she had a coach and a team waiting for her, she had no trouble going to practice. But when it was just for her, she had trouble going. Finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do when they want to do it in their own way. If you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to do the opposite. They're often frustrated because they don't even want to tell themselves what to do. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to raise, I'm going to go through the four, and I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Okay. Upholder, readily meets outer and inner expectations. Okay. Next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do it if they think it makes sense. Obligers. Obligers readily meet outer. They have trouble to meet inner. Okay. Rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. And who did not find themselves in this framework? Okay, it's pretty good. Pretty good. So this is pretty consistent with what I see everywhere, which is that rebel is the smallest category. It's a conspicuous category, but it's a very small category. And then next, though, is upholder. And this was a gigantic revelation to me when I was writing this book, because I thought I was pretty average. And it turns out I'm actually on the freaky fringe. And I, you know, I said to my husband, you know, like, I am this extreme personality. And he's like, yes. And I said, how did you know? He said, I'm married to you. Very few people are upholders. It's a very rare category. So the two extremes are small. Almost everybody are obligers or questioners. I think obliger is a slightly bigger category, but many, many, many people are questioners too. Yes? Oh, it has. It has. These seems to be very consistent.
I was wondering if the rebels just aren't in the group that would come to a reading.
All right. Right. Nope. Right. She said, would rebels come? Well, a rebel would come if a rebel wanted to come. Right. But not because they said they would, not because they RSVP'd yes, not because it would be rude, not because they signed up, not because it's the rule. They might do it out of love for you. They might come. But the question is, can you change? Can you change your spots? And the fact is, from my observation, these are like hardwired. They are with you from the beginning, and they are. It's a ubiquitous aspect of your personality which shapes your perspective on the world. You know, and not, I mean, I can't even go into the, I've done so much thinking about it. People say things and I'm like, that's so deeply obliger, I can't even tell you, you know. Or like, they'll say one thing and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what you are. And so I don't think you can change your tendency, but I do think that with time and age, experience and wisdom, you can counterbalance the negatives, because all of these tendencies have great aspects to them and also big limitations. And they all include people who are big, big successes and also big, big losers. And it's really learning to manage it. And the thing about being an obliger that's great is that the answer for obliger is very clear. As an upholder, it's like, what do you do to offset the negatives? It's a very abstract thing to offset. But obligers, the key, external accountability. That's all you need. A system of external accountability. That is the answer for obligers. And that's very easy to implement. Hire a coach. Have an accountability partner. I have on my site a thing about if you want to start a habits group of people holding each other accountable, how to do that. I heard, and people are so ingenious. One person was like, well, I never made time to read, and I love to read. Now I joined a book group where you're expected to read the book. Now I read all the time. I just heard that somebody emailed me. I thought this was brilliant. So it was two people at work, two obligers, who wanted to eat more healthfully. So they made a deal. We're going to cook half the time. You cook half the time, and I cook half the time. I have to eat what you make, and I have to cook, or else you don't eat. Problem solved. Home-cooked lunch every day, salad. So I don't think you can change, but I think you can figure out how to manage the downsides so you get the benefits of whatever you are without the limitations. Yes?
I just want to say thank you for your happiness project. Oh. It's very amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I have a two-part question. One, you have a habit that you're currently working on or you have put off.
Ah. Well, the first question, okay, this is a habit that I just can't do. I mean, I just simply cannot do it. I cannot make myself pick up the phone messages. I don't know why. I hate that more than anything. And I keep trying to do all the things that I know would work. You know, like every time you pick up the phone and hear that beep, 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 just do it right away. You know, no delay. I can't do it. You know, do it every morning, like pick up the phone and see if there's messages. I can't do that. And then I get very tense because I'm like, oh, well, who knows what those messages are? It could be terrible. And so then I thought, well, okay, well, my husband, he won't pick up the messages, but he doesn't mind. He just doesn't care. So now what I'm trying to do is like just hand him the phone and a pad of paper and a pen and be like, you listen. And he'll do it if I do it, but I can't even form the habit of making him do it. Because as an upholder, I want him to do it. And he's a questioner, so he's like, why should I do it? He's like, if it's important, they'll call us on our cell phones. Yeah, and then my sister said, well, why don't you go into your phone and make one of those messages where we don't pick up messages from this phone, so don't leave a message. I'm like, but then I would still have to go into the phone enough to figure out how to change the message. I can't stand it. So I'm completely frustrated, and probably have like 45. By the time I get back from this tour, there'll probably be like, I don't know. There'll be either none, because people have just given up trying to call us on the phone, or like 200 messages. Anyway, we'll see. And what I'm going to do next, I haven't decided on what my next big subject is. I think that I am going to write a field guide to the four tendencies, because my what I'm finding as I'm out there talking about it is that for many people, they really want more than was appropriate for this book. You know, for this book, I was writing about habits, and there was a lot to say about habits. But so I wanted to do something with the four tendencies where I would really go much more deeply in. And what people keep asking me to do, first of all, is teams. How can teams work? And then also, it's like they really want, like, I'm an upholder married to an obliger. I'm an obliger married to a rebel. I'm a, you know, and like really go through, because there really are these extremely distinct patterns of conflict and what works. For instance, without exception, every rebel that I have talked to who has a long-term partner is with an obliger. That's the only combination that works, to the point where if I know someone's a rebel, I'm like, I know your partner's an obliger. That just happened to me yesterday. This one was like, I'm a rebel, blah, 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 blah. And I said, and can I guess? And exactly fit the profile. It's very consistent pattern. So it's interesting to see. So I think that's what I'm going to do next. It's not a whole big new book, but it'll be you know, a chance to elaborate on something, on the things that I talk about. Oh.
Couple more questions.
Okay.
And we'll start
to
talk. Okay.
Yes.
Oh yeah. And so the fuel for me was fear. Is there other fuels?
Are there other
fuels or
anything? Well, so you had you started drinking more water because you had kidney stones, and so the fear of kidney stones got you to drink the water.
Correct. Fear was the driving force.
Was it fear or was it pain? Pain we listen to. Yeah, fear of the pain. Because fear alone doesn't seem to be that motivating, bizarrely. I mean, doctors are constantly telling people to change their habits because there's going to be dire consequences. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference for a lot of people. Pain, I think, and like that kind of pain in particular, maybe is more persuasive. But another thing that is a very powerful fuel that surprised me is I write about the strategy of the lightning bolt. And the strategy of the lightning bolt is when you get a new idea or a new realization or something, an idea comes to you, and overnight your habits change. So instead of like a slow incremental change, you just dramatically change a habit. Now, for you, it might have been the pain. It might have even been the realization, like, oh my gosh, if I drink water, I will never have this problem again. This is, like, that's all it takes. It's just connecting those dots. Because over and over, like, I've seen people say, what was it somebody was just telling me today? There was some thing that happened to him, but now I can't think of it. I read a book, Gary Taubes, Why We Get Fat. I changed all my eating habits overnight without any kind of transition, any kind of slow, you know, phasing in, phasing out, anything like that overnight. I was talking to a doctor who worked with a lot of high-risk patients, and he said, you know, for some people, they just find out they're pregnant, and then they can just quit whatever they're doing, no matter. It's like so bad, and you think they're so addicted. And then not everybody, but for some people, just that idea. So sometimes just the idea, like, this might risk my life, or it can be very surprising. We often think that we should train ourselves like dogs. And in some ways, we should train ourselves like dogs. But people are not dogs. And for people, ideas are so powerful. So sometimes just having that new idea is all it takes to, like, dramatically change habits. Yes?
You mentioned you're an abstainer.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you mind indulging us on
that? Well, I hate to end on this note. Okay, I'll go one more. Yeah. Okay. I abstain basically from carbs. I am one of those crazy low-carb people that you read about. So, like, for me, nuts is about as far as I go into the world of carbs. So I abstain from flour, rice, potatoes, starchy vegetables, sugar, all that stuff. Fruit.
Well, for Jack.
Yeah, yeah, no, and this is my uncle Cecil, and his brother, my father, is my biggest convert, and it's worked incredibly well for him in terms of blood work and heart medication and all that, and weight, and so anyway, I urge you to. And the reason I did this, I read Why We Get Fat, and it was like lightning bolt, and I became convinced. And because I was convinced, my habits changed, and then I had a good result. And of course, that's very, very, reinforcing. But also, I was a person. I have a tremendous sweet tooth, and I had a lot of cravings. You know, and I hated that feeling, that buzziness of food, and that just goes away. So for me, it's so freeing. I love it. I'm not saying it's for everybody, but for me, it's been great. Okay, one last question. Yes?
How do you start a study?
Huh?
How do you start a study? I mean, do you just...
Oh, I don't do studies? I don't do studies.
I mean, how did you find out how people have habits?
I observe, I research, so the question is, do I do studies? No, I don't do any kind of formal research. I'm a street scientist. So I just look around, and I do read a ton of research. And like I said, like I would also read related things like kindergarten design or addiction theory or monastic governance. There's a lot about habits and monastic governance. So I'll do that. I read a lot of memoirs and biographies to try to see patterns of habits that might observe. But really, when I think back on things that really hit me, or when I feel like I got real insight, it's almost always from somebody that I know telling me something. You know, it's just seeing the pattern. I feel like the hardest thing is to see what is happening right in front of us. And I feel like, say, with obligers, there's a pattern in their lives, but they don't understand what the pattern means. And so it's not that I could do a study on it, because there's nothing to study. It's an observation about human nature, or looking for patterns, like the thing about the marathon. It was like, why are all these people saying the same thing? Or why are all these people having the same coin? You know, all these people saying to me, why can't I take time for myself? And I'd be like, well, why can't you? And then I was like, well, why can't they? I mean, why can't they? Because they can't. So why can't they? So, yeah. So my study of human nature is very observation. It's of that, doing it that way. Though I love the research. I read it all the time. And I draw on it a lot. It can be very revealing. So thank you very much. Buy a book. Buy lots of books at this wonderful bookstore. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.